The supposed hatred of the poor for the rich, which was utterly non-existent in America until the communists went to work to develop it, has been a necessary ingredient of every murderous insurrection in the name of the proletarian revolution which the communists have contrived to inflict on society since the days of the French Revolution. And hatred, assiduously magnified and publicized far beyond its real extent, has been the one always recurrent factor in almost every revolutionary formula which the communists have devised. In the United States, this factor has been most important and most effective in two areas of communist strategy. One is the gigantic fraud known as civil rights. Until the communists got into the picture, the goodwill that had gradually developed and had come to be taken for granted between the Negroes and the white people in our country was a marvelous tribute to both and to the benefits of the American political and economic system. Even Ebony, the leading Negro magazine in America, once said that the United States had made more progress in solving a difficult racial problem than any other nation in history. And because of the advantages and opportunities offered to even the poorest of our citizens, where individual freedom and opportunity prevailed in an expanding economy, a miracle had occurred. Starting only 100 years ago as 4.5 million penniless former slaves, the American Negroes, largely by emulating their white neighbors and with the increasing goodwill and even active help of the white people as a general rule, had arrived at the amazing position of already having the highest standard of living in the world, except only for the white Americans. This was and is true, whether the comparison be of material standards, such as the ownership of automobiles, homes, clothes, bathtubs, and television sets, or of spiritual standards, such as the percentage of the people acquiring college educations or the number of churches which they owned and attended. It comes as quite a surprise to most people today, only because the communists have managed to keep these facts largely suppressed, that the approximately 20 million American Negroes own more than twice as many automobiles as all of the 300 million inhabitants of Soviet Russia and its European satellites put together, or that approximately twice as large a percentage of American Negroes acquire college educations as of the population of England or Germany or France. And there was no limit to the progress ahead until the communists set out by legislation, agitation, and instigation of civil turmoil to foment and build up hatred between the races as the very basis for their revolutionary progress. The second major development and use of hatred as a tool of the revolution had begun far earlier, as a worldwide program, and perhaps in the long run is even more important. This has been the building up and exploitation of the always potential bitterness and distrust between Christians and Jews. For more than 100 years, the communists have done everything possible to revive and increase this source of hatred, which was actually dying out during the increasingly humane tendencies of the 19th century, and especially in the great spirit of open goodwill of all races towards each other, which permeated the opportunities and open spaces and growing prosperity of the United States. There have been many ramifications to the program through which the insiders of the conspiracy have created such a powerful two-edged sword out of what is now known as anti-Semitism. The communists themselves, and especially those of Jewish extraction, have put great effort into nourishing and multiplying hatred of the Jews by Christians, Mohammedans, and all other peoples. One of the most vicious diatribes ever written against the Jews was by Karl Marx, and an English translation has been available for years under the title, A World Without Jews. To a communist, there is no loyalty to anything except the communist cause, and betrayal of one's own race is highly praiseworthy if it helps that cause. A more important part of the same campaign, however, has been the attempt to equate the whole conspiracy in the public mind with a Jewish conspiracy. For this purpose, great use has been made of the fact that from about 1848 to about 1937, so many of the activists on the subversive and revolutionary firing lines were of Jewish origin. All of the emotional exploitation of this bit of history has completely ignored these further and parallel facts. One, these activists were the riot brigades, for whom the real conspirators at the top, whose purposes were being served by such criminal dupes, had only loathing and contempt. Two, at the very same time that these direct action fanatics were learning to use dynamite, there were very few Jews in the Fabian Society and in other top-level instrumentalities of the conspiracy which were accomplishing a great deal more for it. Three, Lenin himself did what he could to have himself and his fellow communists of the Jewish race hated more as Jews than as communists. Apparently, he even played a leading part in having much of the actual communist program laid out plainly in writing for the guidance of his followers in a spurious document called The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, so that the Jews as a whole would be blamed for the program itself. Four, after Lenin and his rabble of stormtroopers, most of whom were Jewish, had served their purpose by seizing power in Russia for the communists, not for the Jews, the inner circle of the conspiracy began gradually to reveal its own anti-Semitic slant, despite the fact that there undoubtedly were and are some Jews within that inner circle. By ridding themselves of Jewish associates and high-level subordinates with all deliberate speed. So that by 1937 or 1938, Stalin had purged practically all Jews out of the top echelons of the conspiracy, even in Russia itself. Today, to the best of our knowledge, there is not a single Jew in the Soviet Presidium or in any other position of high power in the Soviet government, and the degrading treatment of the Jews who live in Russia has now become a disgrace to all mankind. Five, the money of Jewish international bankers has certainly contributed mightily to the revolutionary movement for at least 150 years. When members or representatives of Kuhn Loeb Company financed the Kerensky Revolution in Russia, it was almost certainly with the expectation that the Bolsheviks would presently take it over. But Lenin himself appears to have been financed for the October Revolution largely from inside Imperial Germany. And certainly, Jewish money was only a part of the vast sums that were already being used by the insiders to carry out their plans. While today the total money that is being provided or can be provided by Jewish bankers for that purpose is a very small fraction indeed of the total money made available for the same purpose by the Rockefellers, Fords, the Morgan interests, and literally scores of other big money insiders whom it is not our business to try to name. There is one key to this whole situation, which the misguided bigots who want to blame everything on the Jews should try to grasp. It is that the Jews, because of their experience with persecution in the past, have acquired over the centuries a feeling of closely knit clannishness in the face of possible further persecution, which has made them very susceptible to the wiles of the demagogues who want to capitalize on that fear. And as a result, no people in history have ever been so betrayed or so easily betrayed by power-seeking scoundrels within their own ranks as have the Jews. In our opinion, for instance, and we might add in the opinion of many of the best informed and most courageous Jews themselves, the so-called Anti-Defamation League, which ostensibly was founded to prevent or diminish anti-Semitism, has actually done more over the past few decades to promote anti-Semitism than all of the Gerald L. K. Smiths and Richard Cottons put together. For the ADL's power and prosperity as an organization has depended on an increase rather than a decrease of anti-Jewish feelings. And in subtly provoking this increase, they have, of course, mightily helped the communists, which has certainly been the purpose of some of those involved. But there are two points which concern us most in this whole discussion. One is that the communists, by all of these plans and machinations, have thus been successful in bringing so many otherwise good anti-communists to see the whole conspiracy as a Jewish plot. These people, falling exactly into the trap designed for them by the communists, fail to realize that the conspiracy is using Jewish communists exactly as it is using Arab communists and Negro communists and Methodist communists and youth communists and union labor communists and similar agents whom it can insinuate into positions of influence and leadership among every group, organization, or division of mankind to forward communist purposes. The historical, geographical, and statistical absurdity of this concept that the whole conspiracy is simply a Jewish plot or is run by Jews can be demonstrated by overwhelming evidence. But once the communists planned falsehoods and distortions superimposed on basic emotions and prejudices have convinced these victims that the Jews are behind it all, the poor gullible dupes become absolutely useless or worse in the struggle to expose and oppose the real conspiracy. For most of them spend all of their time and energy for the rest of their lives, not in fighting the communists, nor even, thank goodness, in any effective assault on Jews in general, whom they have learned to hate, but simply in trying to convince everybody else that they are right in their sophomoric interpretation of the problem and in reviling those who disagree with them. Here is a neutralizer which wipes out entirely the opposition of many thousands of alarmed and energetic patriots who should be in the very forefront of those who are trying to create an understanding of the conspiracy. What's more, these people actually wind up materially helping the communists, as we shall see. For the second point in this situation, of great concern to ourselves, is the way the whole theme of anti-Semitism has been developed by the communists into so powerful and effective a two-edged sword. For many years, the communists, using the ADL as a front, tried by extremely intensive and expensive propaganda to have the American people simply take for granted that the John Birch Society was a racist and anti-Semitic organization. And there is no doubt that the attitude thus created was seriously damaging to our recruitment efforts. Today, this pretense has proved to be so visibly absurd in view of the actual facts becoming increasingly known that the charge of anti-Semitism does us little harm anymore. But the communists and their ADL friends still keep at it. The other edge of the sword, however, has now become against us the more dangerous weapon. Not only the vociferous dupes described above, who spend their days in shouting that it is all a Jewish plot, but tens of thousands of otherwise good Americans who, whether because of communist propaganda or for other reasons, bear at least a veiled animosity towards all Jews, stay clear of the John Birch Society because they have heard us accused of refusing to name the enemy, or at least of being Jew lovers, or guilty of some crime in the same category. And the far more significant point is that both edges of this weapon have been used similarly with tremendous effectiveness against a great many other anti-communist groups and organizations. In the John Birch Society, it is our purpose to expose and oppose the communist conspiracy with the truth, let the chips fall where they may. In carrying out that purpose, we have not hesitated to criticize the American Jewish Committee or any other Jewish organization for what seemed to us to be pro-communist statements or activities, exactly as we have criticized the Protestant National Council of Churches or the National Catholic Welfare Conference for the same reasons. So far as we know, we are the only sizable organization in America that ever went out openly and aggressively to tell the public the truth about that decidedly un-American and pro-communist outfit called the Anti-Defamation League. And yet, right now, the good conservatives of our country are being bombarded by a constant barrage of dirty little sheets of all sizes and from many sources, viciously attacking the John Birch Society, usually with deliberate falsehoods and distortions, because we do not regard all Jews as our enemies, and especially because we are very glad and very proud to have outstandingly patriotic and honorable Jews among our ablest and most dedicated writers, speakers, coordinators, chapter leaders, and members in general. The blind and frequently opportunistic bigots carrying on this raucous smear of the society do not even want to keep their facts straight, even about the communist conspiracy. They only seek instead to give vent to the hatred that has poisoned their souls and to capitalize on that emotion among others if they can. We belabor this whole theme because it is so important. Our interest is not in defending the Jews in general against all kinds of charges of undesirable characteristics. In America, it is, or at least should be, permissible for any of you to have your choice of personal prejudices, if you feel that way, against the Jews, or against Swedes, or against white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, or against any other group, so long as this prejudice stops short of any attempt at persecution or unfair treatment. But to carry that prejudice, in the case of the Jews, or any other group, to the point of blaming on them the conspiracy that is seeking to destroy our civilization, and which is certainly seeking to destroy the Jews, is to fall exactly into the trap which has been so skillfully, patiently, and laboriously prepared for you by the communists to neutralize the anti-communists and otherwise to serve communist purposes. Our job, let us repeat, and what the communists most fear, is to have the whole conspiracy accurately exposed and fully understood. Whatever the communists can do to confuse that issue is of tremendous value to them. And we are dealing here with the most important single source of such stultifying confusion. Finally, the communists extol the extreme desirability of hatred as an abstract mood on the part of all communists towards all other human beings who are not communists or active workers in the conspiracy. Karl Marx preached hatred and practiced it towards almost all of his fellow men throughout his whole existence. Lenin, Lunacharsky, and many other communist leaders constantly preached that communists had to learn to hate if they were going to conquer the world. One of Lenin's minor disciples, but for a few years a leading figure in the Roosevelt entourage, and now one of the satellites of Robert Maynard Hutchins in the subversive outfits he heads up in Santa Barbara, namely Rexford Guy Tugwell, once advised his New Deal followers that they had to acquire, quote, an energizing hatred towards the established order. All of this is sound from the communist point of view, for hatred breeds destruction, and destruction is their goal. Section 9. For many years, the always obvious and sometimes admitted objective of the giant left-wing foundations in our country has been simply this: so to change the economic and political structure of the United States that it can be comfortably merged with Soviet Russia in a one-world communist empire. And in recent years, practically all the forces of the conspiracy have been working to that same end. The purpose here, in the economic field, was not sheer destruction in any absolute sense, but such a complete metamorphosis of the old into something new and different that the old will have been, in reality, completely destroyed. The conspirators have labored hard and with constant success, gradually to remold the Americanist system entirely and absorb the revamped machinery into a worldwide socialist apparatus of production and distribution. Then our giant economic bureaucracy will become the framework through which routine control is exercised over every detail of the lives and actions of the American people. You can now see that metamorphosis being insidiously carried out right before your eyes. And most of what is taking place can be more easily understood if the fundamental difference between a free enterprise economic system and a police state socialist system is recognized at once. The free enterprise system is based on a philosophy of abundance, which requires overproduction as the general rule, with millions of salesmen always trying to move the too much. The socialist system is based on a philosophy of scarcity, with millions of ration clerks always trying to divide the too little. One important result of constantly producing too much is that the sales forces are always reaching out to introduce their products to wider markets, thus making today's luxuries of the comparatively few become tomorrow's commonplace necessities of the many. While as a general rule, the communist bosses do not even want their enslaved subjects to have an abundance of food or of any of the other normal needs of life. They actually prefer a shortage bordering always on famine, for such conditions make it a great deal easier for their bureaucracy to control the people and for themselves to control the bureaucracy. Contrary to a widely held impression, starvation does not lead to revolt. Starvation leads to surrender, as was amply proved in Poland in 1945 to 1947 and in China from 1947 to 1950. And exactly as has been the case in many other countries, approaching starvation in America will also lead to surrender, not to resistance. When the fathers of families find that the only way they can obtain ration cards to get food for their starving children is by knuckling under to the communist machine which controls those ration cards. They knuckle under. Let's look, therefore, at some manifestations of the fundamental communist purpose of transforming our economy. The direct steps to this end were begun under Roosevelt, with the killing of pigs and the plowing under of crops. The next huge steps in the preparation and rehearsal for the normal conditions of the future came with the rationing of sugar, gasoline, and other commodities during World War II. These measures set the initial course for three great parallel drives. First is the gradual conversion of abundance into scarcity. The very momentum of the American free enterprise system has made this quite difficult. But the communists and their liberal dupes have been and still are working on the problem day and night, and now with more imminent prospects of success. In a new world war, for instance, no matter how phonily it might be conducted, the strict rationing of meat and bread and gasoline and clothing and the government allocation of housing and industrial raw materials and labor and machinery and production could be made to appear both reasonable and obligatory. The second drive, somewhat dependent on the first, has been to make more and more of the American people, and especially including our farmers, subservient to bureaucratic decisions and favors for their temporary welfare and prosperity. But the third and most important of all has been the undertaking to destroy the entrepreneurial spirit in America altogether. It is the aim of the insiders to have all business firms of any size run more and more by hired managers instead of by owners, and to force the absorption of small businesses into larger ones, and of those combinations into still larger ones, so that more and more of commerce and industry becomes a publicly owned operation run by a huge hired bureaucracy. Such large companies are then far easier to incorporate into a whole system of production which is theoretically owned by the people and is formally run by agents of the state, because they are already only one step removed from that final arrangement. To bring about this last development, the insiders have been relying primarily for many years on the taxing power of government, as applied in the following three ways. A. First, the combination of corporate and personal income taxes has been designed to make it now almost impossible for any entrepreneurial person or group to accumulate out of profits the capital needed for expansion. Any such business which wishes to grow in size, therefore, must either turn to the public for the capital to do so and thus diffuse its ownership and control, or it must seek to be absorbed as a unit into some larger company which can supply the capital, usually because the larger company is already publicly owned or can more readily attract the needed capital from the public. B. And the second effect of the same force at work has been through inheritance taxes. A man may have built up a highly successful and profitable business which he largely owns. It may be one which, as long as he is alive, can still make money and grow slowly despite the current tax burdens. But if so, there is hardly a chance in the world that it can be in the utterly uneconomic position of having enough liquid funds to supply the cash which will have to be paid out by his estate as inheritance taxes at the time of the owner's death. So more and more every year, family-owned businesses have felt the imperative need of selling out to some larger company while their own chief stockholders were still alive. C. Giving a tremendous assist to those uses of taxation is the further government weapon of inflation. For inflation, fundamentally, is nothing more nor less than a form of vicious and cruel stealing by a government from its own people through actions and policies which dilute the value of their money. In the Blue Book of the John Birch Society, this writer, while emphasizing that some limited amount of government was absolutely necessary for any civilized social organization, still pointed out that in actual practice, throughout all observed and recorded history, the greatest enemy of man was and always had been government. And of all the means used by governments to cheat, despoil, exploit, and oppress their subjects, the most foul and cruel has been a deliberately conducted inflation of their currency. There is another lack of any need or justification whatsoever for inflation in a country as productive as the United States, where, if the currency had been left passive, unmanaged, and completely redeemable in gold, it would constantly have bought more and more instead of less and less. Also, among the most vicious falsehoods ever sold to the gullible American people is the claim that increased taxation serves to prevent inflation. It is supposed to do so by draining off purchasing power, and hence the demand for goods and services, which causes prices to rise. Actually, increasing taxation not only does not slow down inflation, but is, for many reasons, one of the surest ways of speeding it up. A major reason is that money left in the hands of individual owners, even in so profligate an era as this has become, will still be spent with a certain amount of prudence and frugality, while the same money transferred into the hands of government will inevitably be spent with unbelievable speed and wastefulness. The manifold uses, however, to which the criminal weapon of inflation and the ever-increasing squeeze of taxation have been put by the last six administrations, including the present one, is too large a subject for any adequate discussion here. The point to be noted, and which certainly should frighten you, is that every one of these uses has added cumulative force to the pressures that are pushing and molding our American economic environment into the form of state socialism, which is the communist goal for their world economic order. With regard to the communist efforts to change our political system, we should have to be much more concise. Let us merely point out, therefore, that the objective is just the same as in the economic field. There have been and are many continuing steps leading toward the ultimate absorption of what is now the United States as merely one or more geographical and administrative provinces into a worldwide communist empire. The activities being carried on to that end include the following campaigns. A, to change our republic into a democracy as a necessary intermediate step on the way to a mobocracy and then dictatorship.
This concludes cassette number 2 in the set of 3.